It is Friday, June the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, keeping Yemen's port of Haiti open for helping the needy.
Foreign countries and the United Nations specialized agencies are channeling their support for the civilian population through this port.
Potential troubles for the Trump Foundation and its money.
Money that should have been used for a tax-exempt purpose, a charitable purpose, was instead being used for campaign.
Denuking the Korean Peninsula, plus Ariana Grande gets engaged. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. The UN Security Council has called for all warring parties in Yemen to keep the port of Hodeidah open as humanitarians try to deliver critical assistance to about 600,000 civilians in that city. At the same time, fighting continued Thursday for a second day around the vital Yemen seaport of Hodeidah as a pro-government coalition backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates attempted to wrest control of the city's airport and seaport from Houthi rebels. Marie-Claire Fagali of the International Committee of the Red Cross says it will only aggravate one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
The humanitarian situation will depend on how this battle is driven and then how much respect for the international humanitarian law is shown by all the parties. Today, we're also at a point where we fear that scores of civilians, tens of thousands of civilians will be displaced in Hodeidah. We are also very concerned that the water infrastructure and then the electricity infrastructure will be damaged, which will be detrimental to the population of Hodeidah.
Fagali called for a reopening of the airport in the rebel-held capital Sana'a for humanitarian reasons for the evacuation of the sick and the wounded. She said the Yemeni people can no longer be held hostage by the three-year-old conflict. The capture of the city, through which most of the country's imports flow, could give the coalition the upper hand in the conflict. For the rebels who have occupied the city since 2015, it is equally important, according to Ohio State University Mideast Studies Center Director Alam Payan in this conversation with VOA's Victor Beatty.
It's a source of income for them. So they are financing their weapons and food and really controlling the area. Another one is that Houthis are receiving weapons through that port, which is sent by Iran. Then again, it's almost 70% of the export and import comes through Hodeidah. Also that foreign countries and the United Nations specialized agencies are channeling their support for the civilian population through this port. So it is important strategically and psychologically and economically.
According to the Saudi-led coalition, the plan is to take control of just the airport and seaport, plus the route leading to the capital, Sana'a. A spokesman for the coalition said, "We will not fight a street war with the Houthis in Hodeidah City for the safety of civilians."
And I do not know that really they can avoid this mass casualties on both sides, because the Houthis are not going to give up easily.
This is the biggest battle so far in this three-year war. Is the war entering a new phase?
I think it is entering the new phase, yeah. Especially when the involvement of not only Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabian planes are refueled by the American planes. So, and also the United States is sharing the intelligence. So the United States is also indirectly involved. So it's American planes are flying from both the United Arab Emirates and from Saudi Arabia. So in some ways it has broadened than before.
Well, the State Department's top Mideast official, David Satterfield, told lawmakers the U.S. is not assisting the operation in Hodeidah.
Well, there are different conflicting news that we are hearing. That's not assistance in terms of American troops going there. But if the refueling of the Saudi Arabian planes are taking place, or it is the American weapons and American bombs which are dropped on the Yemenis.
Is this really a struggle between Saudi Arabia, the Sunni Muslim wing of Islam, and the Shia, dominated by Iran?
Yes, unfortunately, it has become a Shia-Sunni conflict. Saudi Arabia, for example, has about 20% Shiites as a minority. If it will be a prolonged Shia-Sunni conflict, the implications will be for many other countries. That's what people are on both sides are hoping, that it will be a short-fought war.
Do you see an end to this conflict anytime soon?
Even if a ceasefire will be established, there is a possibility that the war might end, but still the conflict cannot end if there is not an accepted government in the capital of Yemen.
Ohio State University Mideast Studies Center Director Alam Payan speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
President Trump's top diplomat is making the rounds of top Asian allies to ease any semblance of disagreement after the summit with Kim Jong-un. AP's Sagar Magani reporting now from the White House.
In China,
this is my third country that I've had the chance to speak with today.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo followed up talks with South Korean and Japanese officials to answer persistent questions about whether the president gave away too much to Kim in return for too little. A key concern, the president's announcement that he'll stop military drills with South Korea, which Pompeo told them will continue if the North stops negotiating in good faith. The president's declaration that the North Korean nuclear threat is gone.
It was with eyes wide open.
Acknowledging the denuclearization effort may not work, but Pompeo says U.S. sanctions will not be lifted until it does. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Reportedly, not a lot of details exist in that Singapore declaration signed by President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. President Trump has said further discussions will begin soon. To get a better understanding of all of this and what might it look like ahead, and are there any potential pitfalls along the way, VOA's Steve Miller speaks with Riley Walters, a policy analyst for the Asia Economy and Technology and Asia Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. Here's Steve Miller.
Riley, there are no written agreements, at least that we know of, regarding how North Korea is going to denuclearize. We know there's going to be some talks, but my question for you is this. How do we move from a general declaration like we have with Singapore to something very specific that details each step?
So the process will be a long one. It will require many more meetings, both public those made public and those behind the scenes. It will get messy, I think. We do need to see some concrete action, right? So, both the president has said, these actions will be verifiable. Pompeo has said, complete includes the complete irreversible denuclearization.
When we take a look at other landmark agreements, whether it be the Iran deal, which the president withdrew the United States from, he called it a bad deal. If we take a look at even other past agreements with North Korea, there's been detailed information there. That's been the last step. Are we going to see other signed documents in the future?
I would expect so, yeah. I think we can expect many more signed documents. When those will happen, that is a question, I think. President Trump said Kim Jong-un, he would start almost immediately after arriving back in Pyongyang on the denuclearization efforts. There's speculation that, maybe there's going to be, I think the South Koreans are reporting that big things could happen within the next few weeks. But, I think we can see a lot more to come, many more documents, and hopefully these things are made public so that they can be reviewed on our behalf and on the South Koreans and the Japanese. Make sure everyone's on the table on this.
So if we take a look moving forward, you said these negotiations could get messy. Other people say they're going to be bumpy. What are some of the problems or pitfalls the two sides may encounter along the way?
Well, I know one of the biggest concerns that a lot of people have been voicing are whether or how much, human rights have been brought up on this. Obviously, denuclearization is the first and foremost topic, but when we talk about either, a normalization of relationships or, some sort of peace efforts in the future, I mean, it's not just going to have to be denuclearization. It's going to have to talk about, political prison camps, human rights efforts, some really nasty things that, there's going to be some difficult trade-offs in this, I think. For the denuclearization effort, it will come down to finding out exactly what the North Koreans have, their capabilities, what are the things that we want to target, what we can target, what they're willing to offer and what we can aim toward removing.
Riley Walters is a policy analyst for Asia Economy and Technology in the Asia Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation. He was speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. Up next, Asian-style capitalism. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. News of Asian economic growth, especially China's, often appears in the business headlines, and part of that reporting almost always deals with the growth of entrepreneurism as well as capitalist expansion. I spoke with Philip Lawrence of the University of Sydney about the Asian version of capitalism and whether it's better or worse than Western-style capitalism.
With capitalism, it's so rooted in history. And the nature of capitalism is formed by things that have happened well into the past. And so you can't change your history. Asia can't change their history. So they effectively, their model of capitalism is what they have to live with because of their history.
Does that make it better?
Whether it's going to be better or whether it is better, I think will be sort of played out in the long term. The main question that I was trying to pose in the paper was that is the Asian model of capitalism with the very narrow ownership of major parts of the economy, is that going to be a structure that's going to prevent wild fluctuations?
Yeah, that's right. Do Asian economies rise and fall the same way that Western economies do?
I think they rise and fall in a more subtle wave motion, and looking at the impacts that have occurred in the Asian economies, they have tended to be caused by external forces rather than Asian forces. If you take the global financial crisis that occurred in 2008, I mean that happened because of forces within the U.S. Now, if you look at what's happening in Europe today, that's happening because of forces that's happening within Europe. But if you look at what's happened in Asia in the past when they've had financial conniptions, they've really been forces that have occurred by external forces that have acted on Asia.
As the Asian economies develop, could they end up with the same sorts of problems that Western economies have had?
In the back of my head, I'm saying I don't think so because of some fundamental characteristics of the history of Asian economies. I just got off the phone to some people in Europe and I was explaining to them that if you look back at the basis behind Western capitalism, Western economies, a lot of it is based on the potential of future wealth of a company or an organization. So you're speculatively buying into what's going to happen in the future. Whereas I think the mentality in Asia is to trade with what you have today.
Well, from my perspective, I always see that we think of in the West stockholders, you know, kind of absentee owners through stocks, and then over there these multi-generational family companies, and then plus the state-owned enterprises that aren't anything like what we have over here. Largely,
exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think, for example, I talk to Asian companies a lot, you know, from the lowest levels in the firm right up to the owners of the companies, and these are multi-billion dollar companies, and quite regularly you'll see in the company almost at every level of the company, right down to a driver, a delivery driver, will be somehow related to the owner, and it's almost as if when decisions are made for a investment, a major investment, could be a couple of billion dollars in investment, then they realise that they're playing with the future lives of the family.
And they don't take risks then, is that it?
And as a result, the risks they take are very, very, very considered.
He is Philip Lawrence of the University of Sydney. Here in the U.S., New York State's Attorney General has sued President Trump and his foundation, accusing him illegally of using the charity's money to settle disputes involving his business empire and to boost his political fortunes during his run for the White House. That lawsuit against Mr. Trump and the foundation directors, who are his children, Donald Jr., Eric, and Ivanka, seeks $2.8 million in restitution, additional unspecified penalties, and the dissolution of the foundation, which President Trump had already pledged to dismantle. VOA's David Byrd speaks with Alicia Perhopoulos, a professor specializing in social enterprise and nonprofit law at Georgetown University, for some perspective on all of this.
The Attorney General's office is accusing the Trump Foundation of self-dealing and accusing Trump and his sons and daughter of self-dealing. And essentially, the Attorney General of New York has the authority to bring this suit because attorney generals in each state have oversight of the charities in their state.
And as I understand it, the accusation says that it was used to funnel money to purposes for which it was not intended. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's correct. And what I'm seeing really from the accounts is that money was money that should have been used for a tax-exempt purpose, a charitable purpose, was instead being used for campaign-related purposes and also in-kind kind of self-dealing purposes as well.
And what is the law governing this kind of thing? Because this foundation, like many foundations, these are basically nonprofits. What is the law governing these particular kinds of organizations that appears or is alleged to have been violated?
Well, primarily what you're looking at is the Internal Revenue Code, so federal law, because essentially they are asking the government and the IRS for a tax exemption. In exchange for tax exemption, you have to follow particular rules under the Internal Revenue Code. So things like the money has to be used for a tax-exempt purpose. And then I would assume that there's also New York charitable laws that are involved as well. Again, I haven't seen the actual documents that the Attorney General's office has filed or the lawsuit that they filed.
And the Attorney General in New York is asking for a sizable amount to be paid back for these alleged violations.
Mm-hmm. With any self-dealing that is involved, that a private foundation is involved with, there's an excise tax that's supposed to be charged both on the foundation and on the perpetrators or the disqualified people that engaged in the self-dealing. So that would be Mr. Trump and his children. So any 501c, whether you're a private foundation or a public charity, you're not allowed to engage in political activities. You're allowed to do some lobbying, but it's an insubstantial amount. But political activities are completely prohibited. And so if you gave the nonprofit shouldn't be able to just give $1 million to a campaign and thereby kind of trying to avoid any federal election law rules. That is definitely illegal and prohibited.
Is there any consequence for the people who gave money to it?
There isn't any consequence in terms of liability. So if they were somehow knowingly giving And the foundation was engaged in the self-dealing transactions. It's really as between the foundation and those disqualified people, so Mr. Trump and the children or whoever else was basically an insider in the foundation that was misusing the funds. So anybody that was just donating and thinking that the Trump Foundation was doing what it was supposed to be doing and using the funds for tax-exempt purposes, they wouldn't. There's no consequences for them.
That is Alicia Plerhopoulos, a professor specializing in social enterprise and nonprofit law at Georgetown University. She was speaking with VOA's David Byrd. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The Festival of Roses is an annual event in Bulgaria, a country renowned for its flower, as the rose is Bulgaria's national symbol. Nadezhda Pencheva is the mayor of Gorno Izvorovo village. She says this is a celebration for all the hard labor we put in, and we cheer for the good harvest and the production of rose oil. But the country's overproduction is a concern for some rose growers and distilleries. The recent oversupply and the advent of more flower growers has pushed prices lower, threatening small-scale operators now struggling to cover costs. The rose is the main source of income in Bulgaria's rose region. Philippe Lisharov is the owner of Vinyo Banchev Rose Oil Distillery. He says there needs to be control and regulation on every level in our production, and now a bill in the works might be introduced to regulate the country's rose oil industry for the first time. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition, so good to have you with us today. You know, love and romance are predominant themes in music, and it's very often an intimate reflection of the artist's actual experiences. A well-known American singer is perhaps laying the groundwork right now for new material, as we hear from Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald speaking with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Right now.
If you're a romantic, you might love this story. If you're more of a realist, it may have you going, It looks like a whirlwind romance for Ariana Grande. It has been quite a month for the singer. Now, back in May, she broke up with her longtime boyfriend, Mac Miller. They'd been going out together for a couple of years. Almost immediately, she announced her engagement to comedian Pete Davidson. Now, these two met back in March 2016 when Ariana hosted Saturday Night Live, Pete as a cast member. The website Bossip reported the pair were dating on May 18th of this year, and 2 days later they were seen together at the Billboard Music Awards. The pair then went public on May 30th, all of this being done on Instagram, of course, because that's the way we do it these days. On May 30th, they posted an Instagram photo wearing matching Hogwarts robes from Harry Potter. He's a Gryffindor, she's a Slytherin. I don't know if that's compatible or not, but there you go. They're both also 24 years old. On June 11th, that's Monday, the news broke that the pair were engaged. Ariana was photographed with a big diamond ring, big pear-shaped diamond, reportedly costing $93,000.
Hello.
This week, Pete Davidson covered up the tattoo of his former girlfriend, Cassie David. She's Larry David's daughter. They broke up in May after a 2-year relationship. He also got a rabbit ear tattoo under his ear. Mm. And, of course, Ariana was wearing rabbit ears on her last album, Dangerous Woman. Right now, it looks like it's full speed ahead with the engagement. We don't have a planned marriage date yet. In other Ariana Grande news, she took to Twitter on Wednesday to unveil her fourth official fragrance, so she's taking care of business.
Yes.
The short video clip showed a cloud-shaped bottle with the words, "New perfume coming soon," and it may coincide with the August release of her fourth album, Sweetener. So it's been a crazy year for Ariana Grande. Of course, last year there was the terrible Manchester bombing. Back in May of 2017, the following month, she organized a wonderful benefit concert. And she said she had PTSD after that. It was a very traumatic time for her. So maybe this is a bit of a bounce back for her, you know, feeling good again. We'll see where it goes.
These whirlwind romances sometimes don't end so well, but we hope in her case it does. And perhaps it will lead to the production of some new material.
That's right. I mean, Taylor Swift has perfected the art of the breakup song and the tell-all song. Maybe Ariana Grande will follow in her footsteps, although, of course, we wish her and Pete Davidson the best.
Perhaps the wedding guests will get a little bit of fragrance in their goodie bag. In our goodie bag each week is the Top 20 Countdown. You'll want to pick it up. Your host is Ray McDonald on VOA One, and you can also catch him online on social media.
On our Facebook page, VOA One The Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
And, of course, we wish Ariana all the best. Hey, listen, more big-name stars are going into business with those streaming services. Amazon Studios says it has signed a deal with actress Nicole Kidman and her production company for TV and movie projects. Blossom Films, which was founded by Kidman, produced the Emmy award-winning series Big Little Lies. That was a big thing here in the United States on HBO, probably everywhere for that matter. Amazon also striking a deal with other prominent Hollywood figures, including the Get Out filmmaker Jordan Peele. And American country music star George Strait is leading a new tourism campaign for South Texas, a community there hard hit by Hurricane Harvey, which did hit the area last year in August. The singer owns a house there and has for many years, and he says it's a great place. A lot of people love to go there, and he's encouraging more and more people to make their way to South Texas. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trachoma is a disease of the poor, and it is a misery to endure. It is a painful malady of the eyes caused by frequent and repeated eye infections that scar the inside of the eyelids so that eyelashes rotate inwards and scratch the eye, damaging it. The disease is spread by contact with a person that has an active infection, which means that trachoma frequently spreads among relatives. A person's immune system can defeat a single episode of infection, but in endemic communities, reacquisition of the bacteria occurs frequently. And eventually, repeated infections will cause blindness. Around the world, some 190 million people in 41 countries are at risk of going blind from trachoma. 2.2 million people have decreased vision due to the disease. Of these, 1.2 are already blind. The good news is that trachoma is preventable through good hygiene and frequent washing with clean water, and treatable with antibiotics such as azithromycin or tetracycline. In late May, USAID spokesperson Clayton McCleskey announced in a written statement that two countries, Ghana and Nepal, have succeeded in eliminating trachoma as a public health problem. This is no mean feat. For a country to be considered trachoma-free, more than 95% of children between 1 and 9 years old living in previously endemic districts must be free of signs of active trachoma. In each previously endemic district, fewer than 0.2% of people 15 years and older must be free of trachomatous trichiasis, the characteristic inward-turned lashes, and the country's health system must be capable of identifying and managing new cases of trachomatous trichiasis. The U.S. government, through USAID, has supported the government of Ghana's efforts to eliminate trachoma since 2006. This includes technical and financial support for mapping the disease, the delivery of 1.1 million treatments of azithromycin donated by Pfizer, and impact evaluations in 37 endemic districts. USAID's support to the government of Nepal on trachoma began in 2009 and included mapping the disease in 31 districts, delivering more than 2.4 million treatments of azithromycin donated by Pfizer, and conducting impact surveys in 24 districts. The United States congratulates Ghana and Nepal on this remarkable achievement, which will improve the lives of their people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.